A few years ago, I had the privilege of sitting under the ministry of someone who either enjoyed traditional art or was one step ahead of the congregation. On Sunday evenings, he led us as a congregation through a series of religious masterpieces. He'd put it up on a big screen and he'd ask us to look at the painting and to see beyond the image and to see beyond the brushstrokes and the color and to see the message that the artist was trying to portray. He encouraged us, taught us to step back from the artwork and say, what is being said here? Now you may be pleased to know, or indeed you may not be pleased to know, we're not going to be looking at artwork today or in the future, so far as I can tell. However, on this, the sixth Sunday in Lent, this day that we call Palm Sunday, this day when we tell again a story that is very, very well known, I wonder whether something of the great masterpieces of art in the way Luke writes. I wonder if we can treat it in a similar way. I wonder whether we can see words and the pictures that that conjures up instead of brushstrokes and the way color is applied. And I wonder whether if we take a step back and take a look at the detail and ask what Luke might be saying there, we might see something of what God is saying, what he is calling us into. And I guess the first obvious thing to see is that Luke wants us, he wants his readers, to know that this is the arrival of Jesus the King. The first indication of that is how he sends his disciples ahead to obtain a colt, a donkey that had not been ridden before. Up until now, when we encounter Jesus, he's always walked. We see him walking with his disciples, discussing what's going on around them. We see him teaching the crowds. We see him dealing with sickness and demon possession as he encounters it. But he's always walking. Now, as he gets to the final bit of Jerusalem, he sends his disciples ahead to obtain a colt, a donkey. And he's going to ride into Jerusalem. With this in mind, it's always bothered me that Jesus presumed and actually was proven right when he sends his disciples to get the colt. They sort of ask what's going to happen if someone comes, and he just says to them, tell them that the Lord needs it. And sure enough, when they turn up and they untie the colt, they simply say the Lord needs it and that's good enough. It's always bothered me that. Until I realized I'd missed something. I'd missed something of the cultural practice where dignitaries had the right to use other people's material possessions. And so they had the right to turn up and say, I want your donkey or your colt. And this was true of Roman authorities, but it was also true of rabbis and religious teachers. And by the time we get to this point in Jesus' ministry, he is certainly recognized and respected as a wandering rabbi or teacher. So when the disciples turn up and say, and are challenged, and they say, well, the Lord needs it, that's good enough. But it does ask a question of us. What is it the Lord requires of us? What if he says, I need you, or I need this from you? Is that enough? Is that enough for us to let go of whatever the Lord needs? Is that enough for us to say, of course you need me, of course I'll go, not worrying about where it might lead us? But there's something else here as well. There's something else in this approaching and going to collect a colt in preparation for the entry into Jerusalem. There's something here about Jesus knowing. He knows that they're going to untie the donkey. He seems to know they're going to be challenged, and he prepares them for that challenge and gives them the words to say. He gives them the appropriate response that will allow them just to walk away with the colt. Leads me to wonder how the Lord has been preparing us. How is he preparing us for the next stage? The next stage as a together as a church, the next stage as individuals, the next part of our journey of faith. What is the ministry and mission he is calling us into, and how, if we look at the way he has led us, has he prepared us for that? But there's something else here as well. Something about the fact that this Jesus seems to know, and know that the response that the master needs it is enough. This knowing, this knowledge, this foreknowledge seems to act in the way light and shade are applied to a painting to create mood. This knowing seems to create a feel of this story. The events of the coming week, the fact that he will be betrayed by a friend, he will be arrested, beaten, crucified. None of this is any surprise to Jesus. As he mounts a donkey and rides into Jerusalem, he knows, he seems to know what he is going into, knows what he is walking into or riding into. It's almost as if he is orchestrating the way he will arrive and the way he will be prepared for his forthcoming death. And if it's not seen in the immediate, certainly it will be seen by those who come later, people like us, who will put the two and two together and will see what is being meant by this. And with this framing of his arrival, this colt, this donkey, is pivotal. Because with his disciples throwing their cloaks on the animal and the crowd laying down their cloaks before him, you know, a red carpet appeal, this has all the ascent of a regal possession. Indeed, step back and look at what we're seeing. We're seeing the approach into Jerusalem on riding a donkey being like the greeting of a king. There are echoes here of Zechariah 9:9. Rejoice greatly, daughter of Zion. Shout, daughter of Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, riding and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, the colt, the foal of a donkey. We often read that passage on Palm Sunday, often part of a Palm Sunday celebration. I'm not sure I've heard 2 Kings 9:13 read or 1 Kings 1:38 and 39 read. But there are echoes of those as well. Because when Jehu approaches Jerusalem to take his crown in 2 Kings 9:13, the same thing appears. Similarly with Solomon's procession to Gihon in 1 Kings 1:38 and 39. There is this procession element. There's a pattern here. There are echoes of the past here. Take a step back and look at what you're looking at, and the symbolism becomes obvious. That leaves me wondering, in our approach to ministry and mission, where we might find echoes of the past, patterns of behavior, places we have been that come to us again and help us in seeing the way forward, seeing the future. But take a step back, look closely at what Luke is saying, and you start to see something is missing. And sometimes what is absent from a painting is almost as important as what is in the artist includes. And here Luke leaves out a detail. Interesting for a move for someone we know as a doctor. Someone for whom the details important are the places. He's very descriptive in his detail. Notice in Luke's account of this journey, there are no palm branches. Scholars believe that this may be because the waving of palm branches is particularly difficult to understand. It's a particularly Jewish practice. But that may explain why it's included in Matthew's gospel and not in Luke's. They also say that the laying down of palm branches is much more associated with the Feast of Tabernacles rather than the Passover. And because the Feast of Tabernacles looks forward to the end times, to the culmination of what God is doing, and Passover is more about sacrifice, this might explain why the palm branches are present in Mark's gospel, but not Luke's. So maybe Luke is leaving this out because he wants us to see something, that this is a journey of sacrifice. This approach to Jerusalem, knowing what is to come, is a journey of self-sacrifice, of giving up of himself. It causes me to wonder how much emphasis we place today on the self-sacrifice nature of Christian faith. I wonder how much that has dropped out of our consciousness. Certainly a few years ago, I was in conversation with one of the managers of one of the Baptist colleges, and they were suggesting that the sacrificial element of ministry seems to be diminishing. The days when ministers gave up and came to college, accepted an invitation to serve after college in anywhere in the country or indeed overseas, seem to be fading. She argued that in her experience, ministers that were coming to the college now were resisting a move away from their family, where their family was located, where their friends were present. And if this is true, if there is a move amongst ministers, I wonder how that echoes life among church members. I wonder where the act of self-sacrifice fits into church life today. Where does the self-sacrifice of giving up of our time, the use of our talents and abilities, giving them freely for the use of the Lord, and the dedication of our money in the service of the Lord, I wonder where the act of self-sacrifice fits in our understanding of practice of following Jesus. But take another step back and we find something else here as well. So we continue to look more closely at Luke's account of Jesus entering into Jerusalem. We find another significant feature. And that is, on the journey to Jerusalem, he pauses at the Mount of Olives. We have a messianic feel, the Lord coming, the sense of the Lord coming home to his people. Once again, there's an echo here of the prophet Zechariah. This time it's Zechariah 14 and the promise of the Messiah who will come from the Mount of Olives. He will split the nations and he will arrive with his holy ones. It's in Zechariah 14. In this case, we might want to read the classification as holy ones, as Jesus' disciples, those who were traveling with them. And Jesus' arrival certainly splits the nation. On one hand, you have people crying out, Hosanna, putting their cloaks before Jesus, welcoming him. And on the other hand, you have the Pharisees calling for people to be quiet. But aside from this, it's worth noting that it is the disciples who begin the chanting, according to Luke. Which probably explains why later the crowd seems to turn so quickly from being supportive of Jesus' arrival to those who cry out for his crucifixion. It's almost as if there's a whole sense of people who are just caught up in the emotion that is begun by the disciples. But this chanting, this blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord, has echoes of the past again. The disciples' praise is more than enthusiasm, more than just reaching a destination. Because if they'd really understood what they were reaching, what they were arriving to, they probably wouldn't have been so enthusiastic. But there are echoes here of Psalm 118, the psalm we began with this morning. And just as towards the end we find reference to the one who comes in the name of the Lord, so we find Jesus heading to the temple. But this is where Jesus' actions diverge from what we find in the psalmist. First, in the psalmist, the one who comes in the name of the Lord is greeted by the priest at the temple in a recognition that he's come to worship. But certainly doesn't happen here. Instead, Jesus receives a frosty reception from the Pharisees. And if we read on, we find the chief priests, rather than welcome him in worship, plotting to kill him. And if that's not enough difference, from Psalm 118, Luke's portrayal of Jesus' entry in Jerusalem, if we were to read on, he doesn't just walk into the temple and engage in worship. He marches into the temple and overthrows the tables of the money changers. He cleanses the temple. There's something significant here. Because while Luke's account of Jesus arriving in Jerusalem has echoes of the Old Testament running right the way through it, it seems to always take that significant diversion. Well, Jesus' approach and arrival in Jerusalem just looks just like it fulfills the expectation of those who have traveled with Jesus, for those who've put their hope in him and their expectation in him and want to be where he is. It does not end as they expect. That's the question of us. I wonder how we respond if our hopes and expectations are not met. If the way things happen don't seem to happen as we hope they do. What if the Lord's purpose for us doesn't fulfill our expectations? What then? Do we accept it's the Lord's will, or do we begin to ask questions and think we've got it wrong? Do we think we've taken a wrong turn somewhere in our journey? If Luke's account of a triumphal entry into Jerusalem leads us to a place that we don't expect, then it surely finds its fulfillment in Jerusalem. Because throughout most of Israel's history, Jerusalem was the center of the nation. Since the time of Solomon, it's been the home of the temple, the sign of God's presence among his people. And its desolation during the time of exile became a symbol of the desolation of the people of God, which is why the rebuilding of the temple was such a big thing, which is why the returns under Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah are so important to the story the people of God tell, which is why now as Jesus approaches, he weeps for the city itself and its temple. With its destruction, with the destruction of the city, what will happen just a few years later will come the final destruction of the temple. Here, as Jesus weeps over the city, we see how seriously he takes this journey. This is Israel's last chance. Israel's time has effectively run out. It's all going to come to an end. And so he weeps. He weeps because the people cannot see what is before their very eyes. They cannot see what is happening. Ask questions of us. How seriously do we take the claims of Jesus seriously? How much more time have we got to respond? How much more time to respond to his mercy in respect of our sins for the past and those of our forefathers? How much time to turn things around? I wonder. When we come to Luke's accounts of Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem, there's a lot to see here. There's a lot in the detail. There's a lot to take note of. There are the echoes of the messianic, the kingdom, the kingship of Jesus, Zechariah 9, 14, and Psalm 118. And yet there are always differences. There is that diversion, that sort of different ending, different culmination that comes as Jesus arrived. This is certainly about Jesus' kingship. This is certainly an emphasis on his royal approach. But it's different. And there's a mood of knowingness that pervades this journey. The fact that Jesus seems to know the fate that is to come for him and the fate of Jerusalem following him. This is Luke's masterpiece, drawing together the historical ties of the people and people that people know well and they're comfortable with, and highlighting the marks of the culmination that Jesus brings. And yet speaking of that difference, that tension between rejoicing and judgment. This is a transformational period in history. It brings with it a complex set of emotions, all wrapped up in the complexity of a king arriving on a donkey. And so as we begin Holy Week, as we move towards Thursday when we will share communion together and we'll enter into the darkness of Good Friday, and then as we come to Easter Sunday and we will declare the resurrection, as we begin this well-worn path, as we tell an age-old story, I wonder if it will change us. I wonder if the time it takes for this story to reach its culmination, God will do something significant in us that will cause us to take a step back and to look again. Look again at our faith. Look again at the claims we make about our faith. And see how the journey has brought us to now may well diverge from what we expect. I wonder, in taking a step back and looking at Easter again, it might cause us to evaluate what it might look like to follow Jesus in the days to come. How will that be different in the days of the past? How will it have echoes of the past and yet be significantly different? I wonder if this Holy Week we might have the courage to step back and look again at the Easter story, and to see and to hear and to allow God to speak again. That we might see, as if for the first time, what the Lord is doing and what he longs to do in us. Amen.